Paul Venner is physical performance coach for the Dutch national baseball team and owner and founder of Ultimate Instability Training Company. In this chat, we discuss dynamical systems theory, the uniqueness of Dutch baseball, and how instability can help build robust athletes.
Welcome to the Well-Traveled Wellness Podcast. Maximum performance, minimum fun. Critical wisdom and actionable insights from leading minds in the field of human performance around the globe. And now, here's your host, Jake George Schuster.
Welcome back to the Well-Traveled Wellness Podcast. Today we're calling across to Eindhoven, Holland, to talk to Paul Venner, performance specialist for the Netherlands baseball and softball teams, and creator of Ultimate Instability Aqua Bags, which are a pretty cool tool for enhancing kind of exercise dynamics, which I'm excited to talk about. So welcome to the show, Paul.
Thanks, George. Good to be on there. It's an honor.
So Paul, for the audience who might not know who you are because you're a little bit humble on social media, can you introduce yourself and tell us your journey thus far in the field?
Yeah, of course. I've always been interested in looking at performance and how to improve it and looking for the limiting factors of performance. So what are the bottlenecks to actually improve it and what are the priorities in that? And my journey started when I was unsuccessful as an athlete. I think a lot of coaches start there, right? So I was always trying to figure it out myself. And obviously I went to university because that was a logical step. And there I met Frans Bosch, who was a lecturer. And it really resonated with me. And intuitively, it made a lot of sense and a lot of things fell on the right spot. So then it was really confirmed that that was what I wanted to do. So I continued on that path and did my final internship at the New South Wales Institute of Sports in Sydney. So that's closer to where you're at right now, right? And yeah, from there on, I started with a work placement at the NOC-NSF, the Netherlands Institute of Sports, as a strength and conditioning coach, first as a junior with some talent programs and building up towards the national programs in many different sports, from swimming, equestrian, to baseball. Yeah, did many sports in that time on many different levels. And that was also where I was introduced to baseball. And now since half a year, they asked me to go into baseball from the federation. So now I'm pretty much full time consumed with that sport. Yeah. And besides that, I do many other things, but that's the main sport that I'm working with myself at the moment.
Awesome. As you mentioned, we were lucky enough to share a sort of advisor, if you will, in our careers, and that is Frans Bosch, who I've worked with, you know, only peripherally in my PhD project, but you've worked with extensively, and I know you do many seminars with him and so on and so forth. And I've always found it really neat that one of the sports that he uses to give certain examples in his teaching around dynamical systems theory is baseball. What about baseball lends itself to teaching with dynamical systems modeling?
I think baseball, I don't think it lends itself more to it in particular than any other sport. I think the model in its own really lends itself really good for improving movement. But baseball is a really nice combination of closed and open aspects. And I think the movements are really good, able to break down. So you've got really specific skill sets and movements that can be broken down and can be looked upon within this dynamic systems theory framework. But the reason that that what we do in baseball, like Franz obviously often gives it as an example. I've heard that in some podcasts before as well, also in yours, which was nice to listen to, by the way. We started the baseball, I think, 5 years ago, because also in the youth programs, the head coach of the youth programs, he got in contact with Francis's theories and was really interested in that. So it basically smashed his old paradigms, and he noticed, wow, I need to do things differently. And along the way, we built that up. And for me, like, I've never knew better because I've been practically spoon-fed with it. So I've never had a lot of other assumptions, like, really built on the physiological track.
You're one of the lucky ones.
So, yeah, for me, it all made sense and was really normal. And I've always been going into that direction. So I think it's much harder if you've been looking in another direction for 20 years and then you see you kind of going into a dead end on some aspects. And it sometimes can be really hard to look at it from a different perspective and bring into account different sciences that are so important in our job working with human beings.
So, Paul, if I was a Major League Baseball executive who's been pouring money into analytics and now wants to turn some attention to the physical preparation side, and I'm listening to this, how would you explain we don't need to explain what dynamical systems theory is, but how would you give an example of it and kind of a little bit around the way that you teach baseball skills in your profession?
Yeah, I think the basis starts with how the body is designed for what it can do. So just the basically the anatomy, biomechanics, but also the motor control aspects. So if you've got so many possibilities of movement, how can you orchestrate it in a way that it actually works well? I think that's a really important thing to take into account. So how does the body control movement, and then how is movement learned? And if you look at how movement is learned, like, for example, how a baby learns, like, nobody is talking to the baby and telling it to do whatever it should do. It's just exploring its surroundings, and from there it's improving and learning because it has really specific intention of what it wants to do. Like, there's something interesting that's making noise, or that's shiny, a nice object, and it wants to go there. So it's, and that's also, I think you talked about it with Franz as well in the podcast shortly, like this intention action model.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you've got a clear intention, then the action can follow on that, and you can also you get back whether you were successful or not. And this information of whether you're successful or not is really important, because from there on you can learn and make improvements. And the more you are successful, the more those strategies will stick. But also, like, the negative information is really important when you are not successful. So, basically the approach, the constraint-led approach, in which you create the circumstances in the task, environment, and organism to get the desired performance outcome. And by constantly manipulating those factors towards your desired performance outcome, you get improvements without explicitly telling someone. So I think still too much in practice, in coaching, like people are really explicitly telling with an internal focus what someone needs to do. And this is because we look at it from the outside, like we're the expert, we know what we want to see, and then we just say, yeah, this is what we want to see. But that's not how the person that needs to perform it, how that person sees it, and how that person deals with that information.
That's a very good answer, Paul, and it definitely informs on dynamical systems modeling. I'm going to push you a little bit to say, okay, so if let's say I'm a major league executive listening to this, this is all really interesting theory, which makes perfect sense. What does it look like? So if you were going to approach a new group of baseball athletes, what would you do with them? And maybe just give an example of a favorite drill of yours.
Yeah, I think a really important point is like movement analysis, because from the movement analysis, you can see where injury risks are, because so I think that's really important to look at, to go from an analysis, and from there on you see the risks and performance limiting factors, and then you can build your training exercises around improving those factors.
Okay. What does your movement screen or your, you know, movement analysis look like in such a rotational sport?
Yeah, so I like to go from like the really end, and that's the actual sports movement. So for example, if you take a pitcher, look at someone pitching and break that down according to our model, looking at which factors need to be stable and need to be that come really precise, and which factors are really important to make it adaptable to the situation. So you see, if you look at 100 experts, you see that those 100 experts have certain things in common that they all do, and certain things that everyone does differently. So this way you can break it down in what are certain aspects in the movement that are within this dynamic systems approach have more an attractor type function, and which parts don't really matter that much how it actually is performed. And it can be different depending on type of pitch, depending on circumstances.
Yeah, I'd imagine that especially like in pitching, you know, there's so many specific kind of subjective examinations. Like I know when someone like Dontrell Willis came into the game, or maybe 10 years ago, and everyone said he's an electric pitcher, but his movements is very conducive to a short career with lots of injuries. And if you can break it down and become a bit more objective, I might have said that backwards, but if you can break it down and have more concise, you know, things which you're looking for in your analysis, that really can kind of professionalize quite a traditional game, can't it?
Yeah. So I think that's the one end point. So really looking at the end movement, and you can see if you go, I mean, you really have to go into detail, but you can find pretty substantial things there that, yeah, can be fixed and should be fixed and can really improve like the performance, but also the longevity of the athlete, because it can improve the robustness of how to deal with those enormous impacts. So if there's in the whole chain, if there's a leakage of energy on a certain point because it's not going optimally, that will be the point where someone is prone to injuries. And I think Franz gives a really good model to do certain analysis on, like with the way he is breaking down the movement and looking at the muscle function going from there, building up towards the movement. So that's at one end of the spectrum. And at the other end of the spectrum is just like physiotherapeutical movement screening, postural analysis, seeing whether there at that level are already certain things that need to be taken into account. And if you've got, and in between are like performance tests, from jumps to med ball tosses, name it. And then I think you get quite a nice spectrum, which can give you a lot of information.
I'm curious, personally, and I'm a bit uninformed on this, Paul. Can you tell us a bit about the unique type of situation, which is Netherlands baseball with, you know, obviously you've got a few former colonies in the Caribbean, which are contributing an incredible amount of talent to the Netherlands baseball, you know, player pool. And this is contributing to some amazing international success. What's this like from working within the federation and how you manage athletes, if that's part of your job at all? Or, you know, the constraints on your communication and programming. And also, what does it mean for the future of Dutch baseball?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I think what you see with the Netherlands Antils is a quite unique situation, which makes it a really a talent hotspot, because you got, it's part of the culture. So everyone's doing it. It's really good weather. The circumstances are not ideal, are not really good, but that's actually what you want, because they have to compensate and have to adjust all the time.
You mean socioeconomically and things like that?
Yeah, like the fields, I think in a lot of like Western developed countries, like everybody's moving to artificial turfs and everything. Yeah, everything is too perfect. So you never train around that movement in a way that you would if you are playing on a field with stones and with equipment that's not so good anymore. So the ball is going in all directions. And
right.
Yeah, that adds a natural form of variability. So I think they are automatically already training within this constraint-led approach in a really nice way. So, yeah, so that's definitely a good point to look at. And in the Netherlands, you see baseball is not that popular. So we need to be far more careful with our like talents. And we need to be really smart with our approach, because like we don't have the numbers that you have in America, for example. And you can say, well, we've got these amount of athletes and everybody going into this big pool, and there's always coming something out. Like if we've got maybe 20 talented athletes that have a potential to become a professional, that's already a lot. And then making professional athletes of them, yeah, is something you really need to be smart with your approach.
Yeah, and there's a lot of human management in there, isn't there? I'll never forget, I had a friend, his name is Ben Weinberg. He works for the German government in their sports ministry. And his PhD thesis was about the growth of Asian soccer, Asian football, and about how, you know, he told me his opinion, hope I don't get him in trouble here, is that cases like America and China never becoming so amazing so fast at sports like soccer is because of population that, I think he said, passed a certain critical mass of maybe 30,000 participants per age group in such a team sport like soccer. You don't need any more, and it's actually disadvantageous geographically and logistically to identify and develop these players, which is why you see countries like Holland being so successful in soccer and things like that. I've always found that fascinating. I was in a meeting here in New Zealand last week, and we were talking about talent identification pathways, and there are whole regions here where we don't have the resources to identify and develop plenty of talented players who, for socioeconomic or other reasons, will never make it, but, you know, have all the potential in the world. So I think it's really interesting always to hear about kind of, I hate to use this word, but minor sports in certain countries and thinking about the potential, because with a small enough population, small enough geography, you can actually be more efficient with your personal logistics, can't you?
Interesting. Yeah, I think so. And like, I think the Netherlands really benefits from the geographical aspects that it's such a small country and it's so well traveled. It can be, everything is so dense. So it's like one big city, actually.
I remember when I lived in Holland, Paul, and we would be in Amsterdam, and I had friends commuting from Alkmaar, and you say, you're coming all the way from Alkmaar. So yeah, it's like 45 minutes, you know?
Yeah, exactly. So we're really spoiled when it comes to traveling within the country.
So you've got this company called Ultimate Instability, and you make these aqua bags, and we've seen teams like the Brumbies and Super Rugby use them. Really fascinating tools, and in a hypersaturated market for kind of exercise tools and gadgets, this brand really seems to stick and really seems to have a future in the industry. So I'm pretty excited to hear about this. Can you kind of tell the audience what these are and what they're used for?
Yeah, of course. It's like Ultimate Instability. The aim of Ultimate Instability is to use the instability and unexpected disturbances as a driving force for better movement and change. And our first products are the aqua bags and aqua balls, and they are like becoming really popular, and they are really used a lot in elite sports and like rehabilitation, strength and conditioning, speed and agility forms. And what it basically is it's a water-filled bag. So you decide how heavy you make it and you pump it up with air. So this water is, you've got this mass that's constantly moving and really unpredictable. So every repetition you make automatically is different every time. So this is really nice in improving the movement, because every time your body needs to adapt to it in a different way to get the same result, the same outcome. So you automatically increase the variability within your movement. And also you can get training on really high intensity, because of the inertia of the water, if you make a quick movement and then you go the other way, you get this impact. So you can, I think one of the big things that concerns, if people see it for the first time, sometimes they think, oh, it's just stability and stability training. It's just standing on a Bosu ball or on a Swiss ball or on an unstable surface, and you're wobbling a bit to left and right, you know? So people have this idea of stability training, that it's just wobbling a bit, something like that. And I think people have a really big misconception of what stability is, because stability is way more than that, especially dynamic stability. It's just being successful in your movements in all the different situations. So yeah, I think the aqua bags and aqua balls really contribute to that.
It's a good explanation, Paul. And one of the things I really like about the look of them is I noticed in my own PhD intervention, you know, in some of the stepping exercises and some of, you know, the Franz designed exercises, that we were able to progress up to a small weight. But then when we wanted to go a little bit heavier, maybe turn a press into a clean or a snatch and this type of thing, that it was just too much. And I was wishing for some kind of middle ground, some kind of not too light, but pretty lightweight, which had some extra, you know, dynamical constraints. And this is just perfect for that.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the thing, because if you've got 10 kilograms or 5 kilograms, something is really light. So you can really explosively make the movement, But then if you have to stop in this end position, you have to deal with all this, this mass going in every direction, which is extremely hard. Everything needs to go in full co-contraction to hold that position.
It looks like in the videos, so that's quite a postural demand as well.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. Sure. And like in the beginning, you mentioned like proprioception, and the thing with proprioception is that there's this feedback mechanism that's taking up some time. And I think that the nice thing, like control on co-contraction, is that it is going automatically because of the anatomical constraints of the muscles. So you really can improve this control of co-contraction around joints with this unexpected load, because you cannot anticipate too much on it. And I think that's really important in exercises anyway, that as soon as you know how to anticipate on it, you're going to learn less. You need to trigger the body in a different way. So it has to adapt again. It has to find different ways again.
Well, that's constant demands, right?
Yeah. The more there is a change between, yeah, what the body is doing and then what's happening, it gets this trigger. Oh, I need to be on there, right?
Yeah. I think it's just so cool. It's just a simple implement for all sports training, Paul, because I noticed, you know, we walk a fine line in sports training between drills that are simple, drills that are work, and, you know, drills that are working and drills that are entertaining enough to keep our athletes engaged. And
yeah.
I think that instead of making the drills on the borderline of too complicated, if we can keep them simple, but just add an implement which makes them always dynamic, then bingo.
Yeah.
So last couple of questions for you. If you were approaching a new group of athletes or giving advice to a fellow strength and conditioning coach and wanting to educate him kind of on your philosophies, what are your three keys to success with physical preparation for a group of athletes?
I think the key is to, like you also say, the key is to make it engaging and to prevent people going through the motion. I think that's happening way too often, that people are going to go through the motion. And a way to get more engagement, that's key point two, is to create ownership in the athletes. So they need to have a sense of what they are doing and why they are doing it. And they need to have some margin for choice in what they do. So I often give them a choice in like a rep range, or in weight, choosing the weight, or I give them like three options of a certain type of exercise, and I give them some room of choice so that they make it themselves. So they make the choice and they've got the motivation to do it, and not, tell me what do I need to do? You know, always, I see it so often, like athletes externalizing their own development to the coach because they are trained that way. So they don't think themselves anymore. And I think then like the learning process is hugely diminished if that happens. So I think that's the job of a good coach, to constantly, make sure that the athlete is balancing on this edge of, full engagement with a task that is just good enough to be successful. So it constantly needs to be pushed on this edge. Like if someone can be successful 100%, then it's too easy. Or if you see that it's, and that's the art of coaching, like seeing when an exercise is too easy, and not only in a physiological way, like just putting on higher loads, but particular in a coordinative way, seeing how the movement develops.
One character one person in the world, alive or historical, who you would like to have a beer with and learn from?
Oh, wow. One.
We can do a top three if you want. We can do a top three.
A top three. I've got a few. They're not per se sports related. I think Chuck Fresco. He's have you ever heard of him?
No, I'm trying to think.
Okay, I think he's already over his hundreds, still alive, I think. He was an industrial designer, also created the Venus Project, but it has some really interesting ideas about human design and how to design an environment to create improvement. And like the cultural aspects of, the cultural aspects of this, really interesting. Another one is, I think, Joe Rogan, Aubrey Marcus. I like those dudes as well, like really eccentric and spoken out on the field of performance in a wide variety of ways. Yeah, I think that are already three.
No, those are good answers. Good answers, Paul. Hey, where can people find your materials, especially the Ultimate Instability?
Yeah, so ultimateinstability.com. That's the main website. And some interesting new product is coming on. So really interesting to keep an eye on that. I can talk more about that in a few months. So coming from next autumn, next fall. So really looking forward to that. Also social media, Ultimate Instability, Paul Venner. You said in the beginning I'm quite humble on social media. I'm planning to go more into that. Gonna carve some time for that. I think it's important to do it a little bit more.
Humility is good, Paul. Some people, we were joking, you know, some people we wonder how they even have time to coach because they're tweeting so much. And, I am guilty that I'm looking at my phone too often, but no, it's really good. And, we'll definitely link to the site in the show notes. And Paul Fenner, thank you for your time today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to this episode. If you leave a review on iTunes, you'll get a free coaching session with me. Check back soon for interviews with Brett Bartholomew, Mark Manson, and Ryan Horn. See you soon.
To learn more about how you can achieve maximum performance with minimum fuss, sign up to our free newsletter at welltraveledwellness.com. You'll get actionable insights from real people on how they manage their days to lead ultra-healthy and productive lifestyles. Sign up today at welltraveledwellness.com.